All right, well, grab your Bibles and open them up to 1 Samuel chapter 27. We are getting close now to the end of 1 Samuel. 1 Samuel is 31 chapters, and so we actually only have three more sermons after today, and then we'll be doing a couple of Advent sermons leading up to Christmas. But today, we're still in the story, 1 Samuel, of God leading his people through people. And today we're going to cover two chapters. We've done that a few weeks ago. They're shorter than the chapters we did the last time, so we're not going to be doing this in a full sprint. We'll be able to actually do this a little bit more slowly. But just as a reminder, this portion of 1 Samuel, these six chapters that we're in, are in three-chapter story arcs. And so the outside chapters, the two kind of bookends of these three-chapter sections, tell the larger story. They push forward the narrative of the story that we've been going through. And then the middle one ends up being kind of this little nugget, this little story that helps us to understand the bigger. And so chapters 24 and 26, we did that 2 weeks ago. They were about David sparing Saul's life, right, where he cuts off the end of the robe. And then we did 25, that one in the middle, last week, and that was the story of Nabal, the fool, and Abigail, the discerning, and David learning a lesson from them. So the greater story that we're going to cover today in two chapters, the book ends, are David and his men moving in with the Philistines, going to Gath, the trouble that that creates. And then next week, we're going to do the story in the middle, which is Saul and the Witch of Endor, which is not a sci-fi movie. That is actually a story in the Bible. Saul and the Witch of Endor, we'll be covering that next week, so come back for that thrilling tale. But since we're moving the larger story forward today, the first thing that I want to do is go back and talk a little bit about what has happened in 1 Samuel up to this point. How did we get here? Both for those of you who weren't here and also for those of you who just don't listen very well. So we're going to say, what were the last kind of 10 chapters? What's going on? So Saul was anointed king, right? He was picked by Israel to be their king because he was a head taller than everyone else, right? There's a lesson there, but we won't go into that. Then he decided to do things his own way. Saul decided to follow his own path, and he decided not to listen to basically that section in Deuteronomy we just read. He didn't put the law right in front of him. He didn't have the fear of God in his heart. Instead, he said, I can figure this out and do it my own way. And while some of his offenses seem kind of small to us, the God who can see through to his heart said, this guy is not for me. And so God rejects Saul, and he sends Samuel to anoint a new king who will lead with the heart of God. So Samuel goes to the house of Jesse, and if you remember that story, Jesse brings all of his sons out from tallest to shortest, and they're all there, and he goes one. He goes through all of them, and none of these are supposed to be the king, and then they go and they get the little boy out in the field, the shepherd, David, and God says, this is the one. This is the one who is going to be king. Now, right away, we see that David has some grit where he lacks size, right? Because the next chapter is the story of David and Goliath. Most people know that story, right? The shepherd with the sling taking down the big giant. And we see that David has something in him that Saul certainly did not. And on the heels of this, David becomes something of a celebrity in Israel, rising up the ranks, becoming a great leader. The people love him. They even write a song about him, right? That famous pop song, Saul has struck down his thousands and David his tens of thousands, which I have thought about writing a tune to, but it just isn't going to work. So he's got this song, the people are singing it, and Saul hears this, and Saul hates that song. Saul hates this song because basically it's saying there is someone who is more important than the king. And in Saul, this transforms into jealousy, and it transforms into anger, and he gets in his mind that he will not be happy until David is dead. And so we've been seeing this. Saul started setting little traps, right? And poor Saul, I don't know if I say poor Saul, but he keeps getting these little great ideas, and it's actually his kids who come in and keep messing it up. Right, David messes it up, Michael messes it up, and eventually he just kind of, Saul is committed to killing David. He's like, I'm going to get this done. So David runs away, and ever since chapter 21, David has been on the run. Saul has been pursuing him, and over again, we have seen how God protects David. And not just protects his life, not just keeps him alive, but he actually protects the kingship. He protects David's conscience by not allowing David to enter into something that would actually bring shame to Israel and guilt on him. David is going to be king. God is making sure of that. God has been the driving force behind David's life, which makes the beginning of chapter 27 so ominous. This is how chapter 27 begins. Verse 1, it says, "Then David said in his heart." Now, this is a clue to us, a clue we might not pick up, but this is a clue to us that things are going to be a little different in this chapter. Because this statement that David said in his heart reminds us of the driving theme in the book of Judges. The book of Judges is the book right before 1 Samuel. And the driving force behind the book of Judges is this phrase. This is from Judges 17:6. "In those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes." Or you could say in his own heart. Now, if you weren't here when we preached through that book, and most of you were not, because that was about 5 years ago, we preached through Judges, and wow, that is an interesting book. But that phrase is used to represent a lack of spiritual guidance. That Israel no longer respected the priests, they had no king, and so basically they would spiral into these times when everyone would just do whatever they wanted. It was ultimate sinful chaos. The idea is that without God's guidance, the best we can muster from our own wisdom is disordered turmoil, anarchy. And so the book of Judges goes through this cycle where the people fall into this, everyone doing what is right in their own eyes, and then God raises up a judge, this prophetic leader who steps in and saves Israel, and then eventually they either become corrupt or die, and the people fall back into the same pattern. They're in the mess again, then God saves them. And if you read through Judges, it just keeps going through this cycle over and over again. Now, as we move into 1 Samuel, Samuel is the first guy who steps up. And Samuel, we said at the beginning of this book, is sometimes called the last judge, the final judge. And he's called that because he really plays this role similar to the judges in the book of Judges. And he kind of comes right on the heels of Samson. But then he is the guy who anoints the king. And the king is supposed to fix things. Because if we go back to Judges, it says, "In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what is right in their own eyes." Which is the idea then that if there is a king, everyone won't do what is right in their own eyes. The king is supposed to fix it. The king is supposed to be the solution. But Saul is proof that a king is not the solution. Because while he won great battles, while he held high position, Saul operated from a place of personal vendetta and jealousy. Saul led Israel by doing what was right in his own eyes. And when he did that, it made everyone under his care take that same approach. All of Israel was now following their king. They were all living in this way. Now, as we've watched David kind of navigate this, we see David has said, "I'm not going to answer Saul's hatred with hatred. I'm not going to kill him even though he wants to kill me." But this does not mean that David will not follow Saul into taking things into his own hands and following his own heart. And that's what we see today. David falls into this trap, just like all of us. But before we dig into that, I want to point out another way that these two chapters are like the book of Judges, and that is they are godless. Right? One of the things that I love about the Old Testament, and if you've been here as we've gone through the Old Testament, you know this. One of the things I love about the Old Testament is it pulls back the curtain, and it shows us earthly events through God's eyes. Right, the fact that God speaks directly into things, we don't have to guess what he's thinking. When we see God reject Saul, we don't have to wonder if God is on Team Saul or Team David. It's been told to us. But while this is helpful to us, that's very different than how we actually experience life. We don't have that sort of clarity in our everyday life. I don't, anyway. So we can learn from the places where God speaks directly, where he guides his people, where he says, turn right, turn left. But it makes it sometimes actually difficult for us to connect to what's going on because we don't live like that. And so we get these godless chapters that are much closer to our experience. And I call them godless not because God isn't there. God's obviously there. But he doesn't speak. And we don't see God providing any clues as to whether he supports or disagrees with the action that is happening. This is a straightforward narrative we're going to read. This happened, then this happened, then this happened, then this happened. And we have to try to make sense of it. Because the Bible doesn't make it clear to us. With that great introduction, let's look at where David's heart guides him. Let's get into this narrative and see the clues that are left for us. So 1 Samuel chapter 27, verse 1, it says this, "Then David said in his heart, 'Now I shall perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than that I should escape to the land of the Philistines. Then Saul will despair of seeking me any longer within the borders of Israel, and I shall escape out of his hand.' So David arose and went, he and the 600 men who were with him, to Achish the son of Maok, king of Gath. And David lived with Achish at Gath, he and his men, every man with his household, and David with his two wives, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail of Carmel, Nabal's widow. And it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath, he no longer sought him. Then David said to Achish, 'If I had found favor in your eyes, let a place be given to me in one of the country towns that I may dwell there. For why should your servant dwell in the royal city with you?' So that day Achish gave him Ziklag. Therefore Ziklag has belonged to the kings of Judah to this day. And the number of the days that David lived in the country of the Philistines was 1 year and 4 months. So David is getting tired of just barely escaping Saul. Right, we go back to the chapters we've been through. He's always like just right there, just barely gets away. And so David says, if I don't do anything, I shall perish, so I will escape out of his hands. And we see David's thinking has become very eye-focused. I need to step up and do something because God might fail me. And the reality is we can all understand where he's coming from, or we should be able to. Right, there's this fatigue that sets in when you're barely making it. Barely making it financially, barely have enough energy to get through the week, barely maintaining your sanity. Don't act like you don't know what I'm talking about. And there's this point that we all get to where we want to hit the eject button. We want to be done. But the problem is, as we see here, too often the eject button that we're looking for is just a way to exist under our own control. To not have to bother with God anymore. To live by our own rules. Because the reality is living independence in independence, not living in living dependent on God, let me be clear, is complicated. And the lie that we believe is that if we take things in our own hands, it won't be as complicated, right? This is hard, and so if I can control it, it won't be as hard. And here's the reality. In the short term, it is. Right? I'm not going to lie to you and say that when you take control of your life, that for the next week, 2 weeks, that it doesn't have that appearance of, wow, this is a lot easier. I don't have to deal with other people. I don't have to deal with God. Why didn't I think of this a long time ago? I mean, take a look at the story here. David decides to run to Gath, the home of Goliath. He knows that that is not ideal, but he's like, I'm stuck between a rock and a hard place, and I choose the rock. So he goes, I'm going over here, and his decision works. Saul is no longer chasing him. The Philistines seem to leave him alone. On top of that, he goes to the king and he proposes, hey, look, I could live here in the city with you, but how about you just give me a nice little country house for me and my 600 men? And the king says, okay. So now David and his men are living in, and women, by the way, are living in peace, in Ziklag, on their own. Nobody's bugging them. And they live there for 1 year and 4 months. Everything is awesome. Or so it seems. But there's more to the story, as there always is. Let's see what's actually going on. Verse 8. It says, "Now David and his men went up and made raids against the Geshurites, the Gerizzites, and the Amalekites, for these were the inhabitants of the land from of old, as far as Shur to the land of Egypt. And David would strike the land and would leave neither man nor woman alive, but would take away all the sheep, the oxen, the donkeys, the camels, and the garments, and come back to Achish. When Achish asked, 'Where have you made a great raid today?' David would say, 'Against the Negeb of Judah, or against the Negeb of the Jerahmeelites, or against the Negeb of the Kenites,'" which are Israelites. "And David would leave neither man nor woman alive to bring the news to Gath, thinking, 'Lest they should tell about us and say, so David has done.' Such was his custom all the while he lived in the country of the Philistines. And Achish trusted David, thinking, 'He has made himself an utter stench to his people Israel. Therefore, he shall always be my servant.'" Then we're going to steal the first two verses out of chapter 28. It says, "In those days the Philistines gathered their forces for war to fight against Israel. And Achish said to David, 'Understand that you and your men are to go out with me in the army.' David said to Achish, 'Very well, you know what your servant can do.' And Achish said to David, 'Very well, I will make you my bodyguard for life.'" All right, so here's what's going on. David and all of his people, they're hanging out in Ziklag, but 600 men and their families, and for David, more than one wife, right? This is starting to become a pretty big endeavor that requires some provisions. So last week we saw the way that David kind of passed the time, and the stuff that he did with his men was they protected the flocks of other people. They actually kept the raiders away from attacking. In this chapter, David and his men become the raiders. So they're all living in Ziklag. They leave out from there, and they raid all these surrounding tribes, and they take whatever they can, and they kill everyone. Now, this seems a little wrong, doesn't it? I mean, the Old Testament allows for a lot of killing. I'll give you that. But only when God commands it. Here, David has decided to just wipe people out for his own gain. Because he needs stuff. And the crazy thing is, God doesn't step in and say anything. He doesn't stop David. Because God doesn't always work like that. Sometimes God just lets us spin a web of lies to catch ourselves in. We saw this last week with David and his many wives. Right? And everyone goes, why does God let David have so many wives? You go, well, in the law of Israelite kings, he told him not to. So it's not that God is pro many wives. And on the other side of it, when David lives this out, there's going to be consequences for him of having many wives. So he hasn't exactly gotten away with it. These decisions will catch up with him. I'll say there have been a few times in my life when I thought lying to sidestep punishment was a good idea, where what I was facing seemed overwhelming, and I thought, you know, that eject button, a harmless little lie, seems like the best course of action. But more than once, that lie became another one. It changed how I acted. It affected who I was. Now, this isn't just a be careful, because if you tell a little lie, it'll grow into a giant monster, which is the plot line of a VeggieTales movie, Larry Boy and the Big Fib, by the way. Okay. No, what I'm actually saying here is that lies are usually the result of us not trusting God and taking things into our own hands. Trying to control everything around us. And when we try to control everything around us, it will end up controlling you. You will be the one changed. And we see it in this story. David taking things into his own hands has caused all sorts of consequences, and they keep growing. Controlling outcomes forces compromises. Specifically, David has to lie to cover his tracks. Right, he's living in a foreign land under a foreign king. He needs to earn the trust of that king, so he lies to that king of who it is that he's attacking. Right, he tells King Achish, "Oh man, I'm going out, and I'm Israel. They treated me bad. I'm going, and I'm gonna punish them." And the king eats it up. Right? Imagine being King Achish and being like, oh, I want to hear another one of David's stories about how the Hebrew came over to our side and is now attacking Israel for us. This is great. They didn't have TV, so that's the best they could do, right? Which leads to the second compromise. That is, David has to kill all in order to keep from being found out. The reason why David kills everyone is so that he doesn't get caught. He raids in order to eat, but he destroys because he has to protect his secret. If King Achish finds out that David has been lying to him, David is dead. And so his first lie has left him no choice but to now compromise and kill everyone. If he wants to be safe, other people are going to have to pay for it. Which creates a third problem for David, which is that David becomes a traitor now in order to protect his life. King Achish believes that David has been attacking Israel, and he's like, ha, look at this, we're actually going to war against them right now. Why don't you go with us? Now, up to this point, David has been faithful to Israel, has been faithful to Saul. He has appeared to be against them, but in all honesty, he hasn't attacked Israel. He's always been, again, just lying about that. But now he is being asked to take arms with the Philistines against Israel in battle. The people that he has been anointed king over, he's about to attack. David has trapped himself with his lies. He is now in a situation where he can't reject King Achish and go, no, 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 I'm not going to go into that battle because Achish will know what's going on and, again, will kill him. He also can't join in the attack on Israel because that's a nation that he has sworn to protect. David's made a mess. So what's he going to do? 1 Samuel 29, verse 1, it says this. Now the Philistines had gathered all their forces at Aphek, and the Israelites were encamped by the spring that is Jezreel. And as the lords of the Philistines were passing on by hundreds and by thousands, and David and his men were passing on in the rear with Achish, the commanders of the Philistines said, what are these Hebrews doing here? And Achish said to the commanders of the Philistines, is this not David, the servant of Saul, king of Israel, who has been with me now for days and years? Since he deserted to me, I have found no fault in him to this day. But the commanders of the Philistines were angry with him. And the commanders of the Philistines said to him, send that man back, that he may return to the place which you have assigned him. He shall not go down with us in battle, lest in battle he become an adversary to us. For how could this fellow reconcile himself to his Lord? Would it not be with the heads of the men here? Is not this David, of whom they sing to one another in dances, Saul has struck down his thousands and David his 10,000s? Then Achish called David and said to him, as the Lord lives, you have been honest, and to me it seems right that you should march out with me in the campaign, for I have found nothing wrong with you in the day from your coming to me this day to this day. Nevertheless, the Lords do not approve of you, so go back now and go peaceably, that you do not displease the lords of the Philistines. All right. Yeah, seriously. David has been released. And David's salvation comes in the form of some Philistine soldiers. Basically, the picture that we have is that David and his men are surrounding King Achish, and they're marching this way, and the lords are marching this way, and all of a sudden, you know, they're looking up and down the lines, and they're probably, like, getting the people riled up, right? Like, we're going to kill those Israelites! We're going to kill the Hebrews! And they look up, and then there's a group of Hebrews. They're like, we're sworn to protect you from those people, and you've invited them here. I mean, they must have known that David was residing within the boundaries of their country, but it would have been a very shocking thing to see him there in battle. And so they're basically asking the question, is the king losing his mind? Does he not know what could happen here? Does he not know, like, has he not read the story of the Trojan horse? Does he not know how these things work? This is how a double cross works. So the commanders of the Philistine army lodge a formal complaint with the king. They basically say, we will not go into battle if you're going to have these Hebrews here. Now, Achish tries to calm them down. You know, he basically says, I trust this guy, right? He since he deserted for me, I have not found fault in him to this day. But the commanders don't buy it. They continue to object. They see right through David. They see actually who David is better than the king does. They aren't buying his lies, and they're working to protect their king and army. Which is kind of funny. Right? The people who don't trust David are actually the ones who are saving him. And the guy who trusts him and listens to everything that he has to say is the one who actually is getting him in trouble. I think there's something here about the people you surround yourself with, but that's for another day. The one thing that is very clear here is that God is going to rescue David in spite of David. God is going to get his king. David has made a mess. God is going to come in and save him from it. And this is David's response to his salvation, verse 8. David said to Achish, "But what have I done? What have you found in your servant from the day I entered your service until now, that I might not go and fight against the enemies of my lord the king?" And Achish answered David and said, "I know that you are as blameless in my sight as an angel of God. Nevertheless, the commanders of the Philistines have said, 'He shall not go up with us to the battle.' Now then, rise early in the morning with the servants of your lord who came with you, and start early in the morning, and depart as soon as you have light." So David set out with his men early in the morning to return to the land of the Philistines, but the Philistines went up to Jezreel. So David's response to being saved is to declare his innocence. Now, some commenters side with David here, and they're like, "Oh man, he's so clever. He's playing it up like he's so let down, but really he's thanking God for getting him out of it." I don't buy it. I read this, and I see David's response is actually very human. You actually see how much that year and 4 months has distorted David. And what I mean by that is when we look inward and begin to trust ourselves for meaning, for truth, for guidance, it changes how we view ourselves. When we are the ones guiding, we can't allow a crack in the armor. We have to be innocent, because if we're guilty, then we can't be trusted, and everything falls apart. So even though David is guilty, he's been lying to the king for a long time, he doesn't feel guilty because he's justified every decision that he's made. He truly is committed to King Achish. I believe that. I believe he sees him as someone who has been there for him, who has saved him, who has helped him. But his commitment to King Achish is actually blinding him from the reality of what his role is. I think he's ready to go up in battle against Israel. Now, you might think that seems implausible. Can David really be that distorted here? The reality is that's what sin does to all of us. Walk into any prison in America and ask the people there if they are guilty. A few of them will fess up to it, right? There's always a few who plead guilty. But most of the people there will tell you that the situation made them do it. They didn't have a choice. If you were in the same situation, you would have done the same thing. And I only use that example not to put them in a different camp, but to say, that's the way we work. That's the way we think. I would say, without the work of Jesus Christ on the cross, I agree, I would do the same exact thing. Now, does this mean that every person who's not a Christian will end up in prison or some sort of... No, of course not. Right, Grant mentioned before common grace. God's common grace has established a moral order for the world, thank God, and gives people different loves and pressures that keeps our sin from reaching its full potential. This world is not as bad as it could be. But what should be very clear to us is that the root of all sin is believing that things would be better if I was in control. That when it comes to me, myself, and I, no one else knows what I need, including God. And if you live like this, you will eventually come face to face with the consequences of your compromises. You, like David, will spin a web that you get caught in. You will see how your deviations from God's plan has hurt people. You will see how it has changed you. You will see how you have dug a hole that you cannot get out of. And at that moment of desperation, you can double down on your own innocence. And a lot of people do. Right? Ah, there's got to be a way why, the reason why this isn't actually as bad as it seems. Or you can turn to God for salvation. And it's in that moment of desperation that you can actually feel the weight of grace. Of God pulling you out of your own mess. It's at that moment that you can understand how good the gospel actually is. Which is the interesting thing about this story as well. I've said that David is a precursor or a foreshadowing of Jesus Christ. In this story, this is a contrast to the gospel. David is actually the anti-Jesus here. Right? In this story, David sinned and found peace in this world, at least for a time. Jesus didn't sin and found strife. David was acquitted even though he was guilty. Jesus was found guilty even though he was innocent. David was released from the earthly consequences of his sin. He was freed from the situation. Jesus took on the full weight of sin. David received salvation. Jesus earned it. And the reason why we come here every week is to remind ourselves of that reality, because we are all prone to living by our own heart, following our own eyes. But the Bible tells us we are the guilty declared innocent because the innocent became guilty for us. And we need to keep reminding ourselves of that. 2 Corinthians 5:21 says it this way. It says, "For our sake he made him to be sin who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God." In other words, we are not righteous at all. He is absolutely righteous. We become righteous because he is willing to sacrifice himself for us. And that is not just a future reality. That is not just the heaven on the other side. He calls us to live out this righteousness now. To believe and act and follow his law and love others in spite of what our circumstances might be. So as you come forward for communion today, come asking Jesus to reveal the places where you have decided that you know better than him. They exist. Ask him to reveal those parts of your life that you keep from him. Come to be reminded that your control has done nothing but made the gospel necessary. He is the one who has done the work. We are here to receive from him what he offers. And in his body and his blood, he offers us salvation from ourselves. Let's pray. Father, we thank you so much for grace. We have a tendency to downplay how messed up we really are. We have a tendency to think that we would be able to control things just fine if it weren't for these other people who mess it up around us, if it weren't for the situations that make compromise necessary. But God, you make it very clear to us that we're broken, that we're sinful, that we're in active rebellion against you. And even when you show us these things over and over again, we deny it and we justify. And so I just pray that you would not let us get away with it. Put the reality of our sin in front of us. And in that, we thank you so much that there's an out, that there's a salvation, that while we've messed up, that's not where we have to stay. And so I thank you for grace. I thank you for Jesus Christ. I thank you that you have worked in spite of us. Thank you so much for the cross. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.